Motorcycle Man.
Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to the Motorcycle Man podcast. This is episode 464, and I am Ted, your host, here in the V-Twin Cafe over in the corner booth. And today, we're going to dig into some stories, skills, and personalities that make the riding world such a wonderful and wild place. And today, we're talking with someone who has shaped the way thousands of riders tackle the backcountry, Brett Tax. If you've watched his videos, taken one of his ADV courses, or read his articles, you already know he blends deep technical knowledge with a no-nonsense approach to rider psychology. We're going to talk about training, terrain, mindset, and maybe even a little special forces philosophy. So grab your helmet, settle in, and let's get this ride started. But first, the Motorcycle Men podcast is brought to you by Scorpion Helmets, offering high-quality, innovative motorcycle helmets and technical apparel at an incredible value. So to learn more, get on over to ScorpionUSA.com. And Wild Ass Seats. You can improve your comfort and ability to stay in the saddle longer with a cushion from Wild Ass Seats. So if you are tired of those painful pressure points and fatigue, go to Wild-Ass.com and get your cushion today from the real Craig Johnson. And Viking Bags, a world leader in motorcycle luggage and one of the fastest growing companies in motorcycle parts. Luggage for whatever you ride and wherever you go. Tobacco Motorwear, of course, as always, for the best in casual riding gear for men and women. There's only one place you should be going, and that is Tobacco Motorwear. Visit them at tobaccomotorwear.com, and our listeners will get 10% off your order when you use the code MOTOMEN. Everyone here at the podcast wears tobacco riding gear. This is great stuff. I won't ride without it. Your safety is worth it, so get on over to Tobacco Motorwear and get in Dave's pants. All right, time now for that little chat with Brett. Hi, boys and girls. We're back here in the Motorcycle Man podcast, episode 464. Joining me today, all the way from, where are you?
I'm in Idaho.
In Idaho? Mr. Brett Tax.
In Idaho.
Idaho. Mr. Brett Tax.
Now, not Ohio, not Iowa.
Iowa. Idaho. Idaho. Brett, welcome to the show. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic. I just came in from the shop after putting a hole in the bottom of a motorcycle, so this was a great place to take a break and have a chat. And it definitely falls back to my my saying that I always tell people, which is attitude matters.
How does one put a hole in the bottom of a motorcycle?
Well, so what you do is, first of all, you start by finding somebody who will loan you their new motorcycle with 23 miles on it. And then what you do is you take it out into the Owyhee Mountains,
yeah,
and you bounce it off a rock.
Oh,
and then
you
call your wife to rescue you and your old Tacoma. And then you come back and you pull off skid pants. So you can figure how easy it is. Because when I do a motorcycle review, gosh darn it, I'm going to go thorough. I'm going to check out. I'm going to make sure we know what the part supply is like, what the dealer interaction is like.
Yeah.
I'm going full bore. I don't half-ass anything.
That's good. I mean, you do an actual test. An actual test. So, Brett, now you're here to tell us all about your schools that you have and your training programs that you have. But no, for those who don't know who you are, so why don't you tell us who you are, your motorcycle self, and what you do.
Okay, so I'll try to keep it short. I'm a motorcycle trainer. It's what I do for a living. I've been doing it for about 30 years now.
Oh,
and okay. And over the years, I've gone through the whole gamut. I started off by training newer riders, and then I trained experienced riders, and then I did stuff at the racetrack, and I trained kids, and I did a dirt bike school. And on the side, I had a little pet project for adventure riders. And so ran a school, had, at the peak, I think I ran around 4,000 people in a year through my school. So
wow.
It was a big brick and mortar.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of instructors and a lot of stuff. Okay. Military contract, training special forces for 11 years on motorcycles. So had a really fun, exciting, colorful career. However, I have decided that my favorite people to hang out with are are the guys that are on the adventure bikes. So that is all I do anymore. So I've walked away from the brick and mortar.
Okay.
It's just in a small crew, and I travel around the country during the training season. I train people.
All right.
And in the winter, I get bored, and I go overseas and take people to other countries.
Oh, well, there you go. Awesome. What are you riding?
So, well, it depends on the day.
Oh, you're one of those guys, are you?
But yeah, my current fleet is, I've had a lot of the newer bikes, but I keep parking a 2018 1200 GS in the garage. It's modified for doing abuse too.
Okay.
And I've got a Tenere 700 Yamaha that I beat up. But,
all right.
And I've spent time on everything. I love Ducatis, and I spent, you wouldn't believe how many Harleys I've taken out dirt riding on the East Coast. Cause that's when we trained on the East Coast, that's all I could rent.
And, oh, wow.
They got a little muddy during that training. That was always fun.
As they're supposed to be.
I'm pretty diverse. I'm not hooked into any brand or model.
Excellent. Well, that's good to have that. So now your training focuses heavily on the physics of motorcycling and the psychology of the rider. So how do those two elements shape the way you coach your adventure riders?
So in general, what I've found over the years is, let me take everybody on a little trip.
Okay, let's go. Let's go. I'm ready.
Get there.
I'm ready.
So when we start off, and this works whether you're a rider or whether you're an instructor, is you learn something and you think, well, now I know it, right? And so people do this. They take their MSF course, the beginner course, and I took the class is what I hear from people.
Yeah.
Because they know now. And then pretty soon you take the next one, you realize, oh, well, now I know because the last one I didn't know. And then you take the next one and, well, now I know this, but I didn't know the last. And it turns out you don't know what you don't know until you learn what you didn't know, but you still don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And training is exactly the same way. And that's what I've done over the years. And what happened with the military guys is I had a week. I had 40 hours with them. We did daytime training, nighttime training. Most of it was on road. I'm one of the few people in the country who's has extensive time doing on-road training with riders besides just, parking lot. Most training is all in a parking lot or a field somewhere. And what I realized is that I needed them to master it to pass it on to the next generation of riders. I couldn't just introduce them to concepts.
Yeah.
And then I realized, well, they're not instructors. They don't live this. They have regular lives. And probably almost every listener here is the same thing. We love motorcycles. It's a passion of ours, but it's not our living. Yeah. So we have to disconnect from it, live our lives, and then come back to our bikes. And then we want to be as good as we can get, but we're not professionals.
Sure, sure.
And so I started realizing I can't train people in formulas because it doesn't transfer.
Right.
And this is particularly important when I travel around the world. So I've traveled somewhere around 50 countries I've ridden in now. And you'll see terrain that you've never seen before, you will never see again. And as riders, I don't care who you are, street rider, dirt rider, everybody listening here, you have been through corners that you have never seen before and you will never see again.
Right.
And you have to have a 100% success rate.
Yeah.
99 is not enough. Or every 100th corner, you'd be crashing. And that's just not acceptable.
No,
and you don't do that, right? That's ridiculous.
Right.
So that's what I do is I focus on the physics of riding. If we understand how the bike operates, how our interactions work with that, how the environment around us interacts with that, then we could adapt to any given environment, even if we've never seen that exact environment.
Ah,
so that's,
okay.
That's the way I go.
All right. Now, you said that most riders plateau at some point. And because no one has ever really evaluated them correctly. So what is the most common mistakes you spot within the first few minutes of watching someone ride?
So, and again, or do we want to think about riders in general or, because right now I'm focused on adventure riders.
Yeah.
So
these are
generally people are focused on the off-road version of it. Because, if you ride on the pavement and you never died, then you assume you're better than average. But when you go off-road and you fall down, it's pretty quick. People go, I think I could use some help with this one. It's pretty intimidating. So shall we focus on pavement or dirt?
Yes.
Okay, fine. In that case, what I would say is that most riders, and this comes from a lot of following people, being on comms, and not just being a parking lot, but riding with them and trying to evaluate, what do I need to create to train them so that they will not die?
Right.
People are reactive. they're not proactive. And we think we're proactive, but we're not.
Yeah, I see.
And I've done this where I've taken like trainers, MSF trainers, Lee Parks trainers and guys out and riding, and I'll have them on comms and I'll start telling them what I'm looking at. And they start looking at me like, what are you talking about? And I'm looking across the valley through the trees on the next curve, because I'm like, well, yeah, you see that truck? I don't want to be in the curve when I get there. But they're looking at one or two curves ahead. And I'm looking across the valley because I can scan the whole road, what the road's doing, who's coming at it. And so what I find in general is that riders are very poor about looking far enough ahead to slow down the information that they need to process. Let's talk about cornering in general. And just because, you know, everybody can relate to street riding. I don't care if you're an adventure rider or a street rider. We all ride through the corners in the street. And every single one of us has gone, and I'm one, I've done it more than once, where you go into a corner and you go, oh, that was not good, right? And I'm just glad nobody was there today, you know, and we make a mistake and we come out of it and we try to improve. Well, that's just luck. And that's a real bad way to ride, is just, you know, hoping things happen. So the ability to look ahead, to make sure that no matter what happens, we are never surprised in a corner. And that has to do with how we read the road, how we interact. And there's some very simple things we can do as riders that will change how we ride. Like trail braking is one of them that's really undersold for road riders. And I think that's what people make, is that they're reactive. They're allowing information to compress on them faster than their brain can sort it out. And that's often when people say, well, I went into a decreasing radius corner and it was closing in on me. No, it wasn't. You were going too fast. Slow down, you know, and that's what we often don't realize, is that I need more time. And either you slow down to process information or you get the information sooner. Yeah. So you have more time.
So it seems like speed is an issue when it comes to road riding.
But it's not speed of riding. And that's what I hate, is we always think speed, because people can ride through corners twice as fast as you might be riding and do it safely. And they never have a problem, but you have a problem. It's the speed of information. And this happens both because we're traveling through time, but also how well and how fast we can sort that information. Age is always a factor, right? We don't sort things as quickly as we get older as when we were younger. Experience allows us to sort it faster than somebody who's new, regardless of age. And so there's a lot of these other factors that come into play, you know, about that information process. When we say speed, it's not the motorcycle, it's the information process.
Speed. Now, what about off-road? How does that translate to off-road now?
It's if we're talking about that topic specifically, it's the same thing. Yeah. The difference is where we look. When we're on the pavement, we're traveling at 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100, whatever these people are doing on their bikes, right? We've all done all the above and said, well, that was stupid. But so we're looking out sometimes miles, you know, to try to look out at what the road's going to do ahead of us.
Yeah.
In the dirt, that can be all the way from just in front of the tire. If you're thinking about a trials bike where you're moving at 2 miles an hour, well, there's no reason you can't look down in front of you. That's important.
Yeah.
But if they look down in front without having a plan beyond that, then we have a problem. And that's the issue. You can look down in the dirt, but you have to look up first to know what the plan is. And then you can look down and use target fixation as an advantage rather than a disadvantage.
Oh. But what do you do in situations either on road or off road, where you, especially on road, where there are curves, like say I've never ridden, but let's say the tail of a dragon, for example, you can't see that far ahead. You can see maybe the one or two curves in front of you, but beyond that, you have nothing. So in situations like that, what are you doing?
So the tail of the dragon is actually it's a terrifying run. It has nothing to do with the pavement. I've been through there many, many times. Mm-hmm. And it's the other riders that terrify me. It's the other people who can't stay in their lane. So usually I go through it one direction and then I go to all the secondary roads, which I think are actually much better. But it's obviously a very famous stretch of road.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about the tail of the dragon, it's a very consistent line of curves. The curves are, there's nothing really surprising that's there. They're greater than 90 degrees, but they're consistent radius all the way through, which is nice. And most of them, you can see one to two curves. You can look through trees and pick up on the other, depending on the foliage, the time of year that you're there.
Right.
But this comes back to the concept of trail braking. So let's back up and pick this one up because it's one of those topics people don't like. Trail braking is about controlling speed that matches our vision. That's all it is. And as a rider, we never commit to something we can't see. We can't set our speed at the beginning of a curve if we can't see the exit. All we can do is guess what that speed should be. And we make our best guess, and then we don't overcommit to that corner or the speed or the exit until we actually pick up the exit. And most importantly, as an advanced rider, it's the indicators, the small changes on the edge of the road and the pavement, the vanishing point, these different things that will actually allow you to commit to it earlier than somebody who waits to actually see the road.
Yeah.
But that's the baseline right there, period. And I don't care if you're pavement or dirt, you never commit to something you can't see.
Right. Period. Exactly.
You have to have all the indicators or the visual, one of the two.
Right. Now, with your courses, now you're known for your individualized coaching rather than that one-size-fits-all kind of a thing. How do you tailor instructions for riders with very different backgrounds and risk tolerances, so to speak?
Well, first of all, I don't use lines. You know, when you go to most courses, you'll find that the instructor has a curricula, he reads it, you wait in line, you go do your thing, your turn, he gives you some feedback, you go get back in line and wait. I don't think anybody learns very well sitting in a line. I think that's one of the dumbest formats out there, yeah. Especially when you can have riders moving. I don't have to coach you, but if you can make three attempts and I get to coach you every one of three, you would rather do that than get one third the opportunities to go and get coached every time.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, a lot of us want to do it multiple times, make some mistakes, and not have anybody looking at us. I don't want to be critical. Just let me screw it up, figure it out, and then give me some pointers. And that's exactly the format that I have. So it allows me to set up a path of travel that allows all the riders to be in motion. I can increase and decrease the challenges on that same activity based on experienced riders and beginner riders, right? And beginner to off-road, you know, type of thing. And so they're able to ride at their own pace. And if somebody falls down, they're not holding up anybody else. There's no stress there. Mm-hmm. If you want to push a little harder, you can pass the other riders, and there's a path to travel that allows you to do that. So you're not being held up by riders who are being slow. And so the trick here is to take a group of riders and create an individual format that allows them to get the feedback, the coaching, and the flow and practice that allows each one to develop. And that's exactly what we do and why I don't do this as a large format school anymore. I'm at every class that my school runs. There's myself and a couple other guys that do this, but I am there every single time because every class is unique based on weather, based on the riders that show up. Sure, the lessons that we need to learn are the same, but the path to achieve those varies every single time.
Ah, okay. Now, you do teach in multiple states and also internationally, right? So
yes.
How does the terrain, the sand, the mud, the rock, and the altitude change the way you structure your training sessions?
And this goes back to what I was mentioning. This is how I got into this physics-based training, you know, mentality is that, back in the day when I was building curricula and, you know, that was similar to the MSF where I'm like, oh, we're going to do these cone weave and we're going to do this circle. And by the way, I've never found cones in the wild. So I don't know why we all have to train with them. And, you know, there are instructors who believe if you don't have cones, you can't teach people anybody. But, unless I'm in a construction zone, right. I just never see cones on the road. So I really don't use cones. I use natural terrain.
Yeah,
but the idea is that if I have sand in one location and you're training in another location, let's just say you're joining me in Georgia and you're going to come out to the West Coast and ride in Utah or Idaho or something like
that. Two totally different animals right there.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
But that happens. So if you're training in Georgia where we get all our slime and mud, I still have to make sure that you have the same riding skills, physics and understanding so that you can ride in that sand. And so that's really how I got into that physics base so that I can teach you how the bike reacts and how to interpret what the terrain will do so that when you get in these new environments, you have a chance to have a more accurate prediction of those changes as you develop and learn with them. So you're not having failures, you know, because the problem with adventure training is whether you're doing it domestically in the US or whether you're international, injuries are a much bigger deal. You know, ambulances aren't 3 to 5 minutes away.
No.
A cell phone service may not be there. This is a big problem.
Yeah.
So I need you to be accurate. I need to make sure you're not exhausted by your riding. I have to teach you ways to be more efficient in how you ride, more relaxed in your understanding of the terrain, and more accurate in your ability to ride. So that's what I have to do. And that's why the physics come into play. And you would have to be there to really understand it. But yeah, so I can train you in Georgia so that when you come out and ride in the sand, you're riding in the sand. You know, and that's the idea. Yeah. Some places I have hills, other places I don't. But the concepts have to remain constant. Those physics don't change.
Right.
So that's why we learn physics.
Ah, there we go. Now, this is going to be an interesting question for you. Do you, how many riders do you see bring their experience with them and kind of like try to mold that into what you're doing?
Well, you know, I do have a wide range of riders for every class. So those who have never ridden on grass or a gravel driveway, to guys who have actually traveled extensively or rode dirt bikes, taken classes many times, many, many different schools other than mine. There's a consistency across the riders who come to me. I'm not the cheapest guy in town. I'm not the most expensive, but I'm not an economy school. Guys check their egos before they ever show up.
There you go.
I do not get people who show up that want to just be confirmed, you know, tell me I'm really good at what I do.
Yeah.
Every single guy is there because they have a challenge, they have a goal, they want to get better. And they, I don't ask them to leave their skill sets behind. Again, because I'm physics-based, a lot of the things I do help them understand the other things they've learned. They've learned these processes. And sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, because they don't know why it works when it works and why it doesn't when it doesn't. So the fact that I teach them the physics behind it means that they can go back in their minds and go, oh, now I understand why they were teaching me this.
Yeah.
And now I understand why it works in that environment. So my goal is to not, you know, eliminate other things they've learned. It's to explain, is to help them understand, because some things are true, but only in certain environments. And that's something that can be very hard to sort out without extensive experience.
Ah, I have had people say to me that it's not relevant, but I bring it up anyway because I think it is relevant. And what I'm bringing up is mountain biking versus off-road motorcycle riding.
To me, 100%
relevant. I think they're perfectly aligned with each other. Because it's
100%.
Because it's the same. It's the same skills that you need to operate, right?
Well. First of all, I always have to ask this question because I get guys to say, "I agree with you 100%." All right, I'm not even there. There's no debate here at all. 100%. They are interchangeable, but I have to ask guys when they say they're mountain biking, because that always perks up my ears. I'm like, oh, okay, this guy's going to do great. And I have to ask them, do you own a mountain bike or are you a mountain biker? Because those are two different.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, right.
So I own a mountain bike and I go out and pedal around. But I am not one of those crazy nut mountain bikers that's launching off cliffs and everything else. And there is definitely a difference those personalities. And someone's experience, but also it tells me something about their risk taking.
Yeah.
Guys who are hardcore mountain bikers, who are real mountain bikers, their risk tolerance is huge. All right, they're willing to push things, which means their fear level's low. They are so easy to train because they just do what you tell them to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest problem most riders have with me. That's what limits most riders. It's not their physical ability.
Yeah.
It's not because they have a bad joint or they're overweight or they're way past their age prime, because that's everybody that comes to my class. Everybody fits into one of those categories, right? Including me. And so that's not the limitation. It's the fear. And the fear is the thing that causes you to stop doing what you have to do. And it's uncontrolled fear. Fear is healthy if it keeps you from doing really stupid things.
And dying.
But when you can't overrule fear with logic,
that's
when it becomes dangerous.
Now, do you see people show up at your schools with that mountain bike experience and try to employ those skills into what you're doing?
They show up. It's not common. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do get guys who come in with the mountain biking experience, and generally it's me trying to pull those skills that they already own, that they already have, and to convert those into the off-road riding, to relate those so that I can advance their learning at a higher rate of speed.
Yeah.
So I'm the one that pulls it in. It's usually not me trying to pull people back. And I think that might be a difference between me and a lot of other training environments where guys are like, well, that's wrong. And this is the right way to do it. Believe me, I've taken a lot of schools, road racing schools, everything else. And every time I go there, it's always like, well, they're wrong. They're doing it wrong. Our guys are all champions because they do it our way.
Yeah.
And you know, what you learn after a while is there's a lot of different ways to do things.
Yeah.
And you have to start accounting, not just for different ways that work, but also what works for different people. Yeah. At different stages and different bikes and different environments, and be able to adapt those. And so I highly encourage people to take other training. Yeah. And I want to incorporate previous learning, regardless of where it came from, whether it's mountain biking, whether it's shooting, whether it's, whatever it is, I want to pull that in and go, how can I relate that? Diving even, and pull that in so they can relate to, I understand.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to see more motorcyclists, ADV riders, get into cycling, because I just like I'd mentioned earlier, I just think that the skill levels, they translate for each other, and not only that, it raises your endurance, really, when you think about it.
So, well, that's a health thing. I mean, obviously, that's an issue most of us probably can do better at is better health. So that's definitely a plus. The other one that I just started, and because I look like a complete fool doing it, and I love going back to beginners, and I'm not as natural as people think. I have to work really hard. And probably makes me a better instructor because it's not easy. Everything has to be worked for. But I picked up a trials bike, and it's the same skill. I kind of put that. So now I have my mountain bike, and then my trials bike, and then I have my Tenere and my big bike. And I had dirt bikes for years. I actually didn't start riding them until I was in my 30s. But that's an interesting story. I became an instructor, so I figured I should buy a bike and learn how to ride it.
I tell you what, I give those trials guys who can do it, I give them so much credit and a lot of respect for them. Because
it's insane.
Amazing skills. Even the mountain bike guys who are doing trials like on bicycles, it just blows me away that the handling skills these guys have.
Yeah. I joke around when I pull out my trials bike. So I have a Gas TXT 250. And so this bike weighs 150 pounds, 154 pounds. And it's, it's a 250 two-stroke. And I keep telling people it's the scariest bike I've ever owned. And what are you talking about? I said, well, it keeps trying to kill me. And I'm not kidding. That thing has thrown me on the ground more than anything I've ridden in the last 20 years. It's I want to keep improving, and you don't get better if you don't take yourself out of your comfort zone.
Oh, sure. That's right. Well, speaking of which, talking about gear and stuff like that, many riders are investing heavily in bikes and gear and still struggle off-road. What's the biggest gear myth you wish riders would just let go of?
Wow, that's a big one. There's so many out there. For the industry I'm in, I think the biggest thing that I try to hammer into people happens to be boots. I think when we go off road, when we come from the street, we focus on helmets and riding gear and impact, and we don't really think about our feet as much. We just kind of wrap them in leather and we call it good. When we go off road, we don't realize that's a huge risk zone. And because, when you're learning, and that's always when you need the best stuff. And that's where I see the people bring in the cheapest stuff, because you're not invested yet. And because you're going to make the most mistakes, just dropping your foot or just rolling an ankle as you try to catch a bike, or if you get kicked off, it's going to happen a lot more often. And people ride these adventure boots. And usually I can tell people, if the word adventure is in the title of the boot, don't buy it. Not for off-road riding, right? That's your road touring boot. It's a heavy-duty road touring boot. They're fine. They're great. I own adventure boots. But when you're going to go off-road, especially in a learning environment where you're deliberately increasing your risk, then you should also deliberately increase your protection. So I would say for gear, that would probably be the one that I would focus on the most, at least for the guys in the industry I'm focused on right now.
Right. All right. Well, talking about as far as it goes for gear like that, and you're saying boots is the number one thing. Do you see riders showing up for your ADV classes in full blown ADV gear, pants, jackets, or do you see guys just show up in, let's say, Kevlar jeans and a leather jacket? I mean, what do you usually get?
My guys are committed. When they come to train with me, they're making a significant investment in both the tuition of the course and the time it takes to get to the location, because you got to travel. I'm on East Coast, West Coast, but a lot of these guys, this is multiple days to get in. They're spending 4 days with me a lot of times. So they are invested, and I get a lot of questions about what to wear, what tires to have. They want to make sure they're going to get the most out of it.
Right.
So I really don't have a problem in general with guys showing up with less than ideal gear. The only time that really becomes a challenge is those real true beginners. The guys are like, yeah, this is the first time I've ever touched grass. And they're the ones that usually show up with the worst tires and the worst gear, because anybody who's been on it before goes, oh, this is scary, I need it. But those guys, they just don't have the experience and the perception, and they show up and they and that's fine. We work through it. And I do everything. I'm a risk manager. You know, when I go through, I'm taking people and doing very risky things and doing my best to make sure that nobody gets, you know, injured in the process. I don't care if you get hurt. I don't want you injured. You know, there's a difference. And so, yeah, it's the beginners that I think are the hardest ones to convince that this is worth the investment.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Now, you have also free online courses to reach riders who may never attend the class. Now, what skills or concepts do you think every ADV rider should master before heading into the backcountry based on those online courses?
So it's the basics. You know, almost everybody wants to become a master right away. And what they don't realize, and the reason you don't see me have a level one, level two, level three course, is because we're all trying to master the basics, but with a different level of understanding and application. The expert's still working on vision. They're still working on balance. They're still working on traction management. All those same skill sets that a beginner works on. They just have more experience, and they can apply those skills in more challenging environments. That's it. Those are the differences. When I do my challenge courses, I have a adventure training, which is 99% of the riders who come out. That's the best. And for 1% of the guys, I have what's called the challenge training. We teach the exact same concepts. Nothing new, nothing different.
Okay.
We just do it in more challenging environments and at higher speeds. And so I think for that, they need clutch control. One of the biggest issues that people have is clutch control. They need to be comfortable being able to get up on those pegs and stand. And I would say probably universally, as riders develop, the biggest mistake is they sit down when they should stand up, and they stand up when they should sit down.
Ah, mountain bike skills come in handy there.
Yeah, that's it, right? So they're riding down a gravel road, everything's feeling great, they stand up, they're getting air, and everything's great, and they feel like an adventure rider, like all those videos and all the pictures in the magazines, like, I'm badass, check me out. You know, and then they come up to the water crossing, and they all sit down, and worse than that, they'll sit down and throw their feet out, and then paddle walk through it. And I'm like, well, you got that all backwards.
Yeah.
When you're still along in that gravel road, sit your butt down, save the energy. So that you have the energy when things don't go right, or when you're in a challenging environment. And when you get to the water, you should be standing up. Anytime your little brain alerts you and says, I think I might die, that's your alert that says, I should stand up. This is my stand-up worry, right? It's when I'm worried, when I'm concerned, when I'm not sure what's going on, that just means stand up. And you know, as riders first get into this, until they learn how to do this well, that's the major mistake I see with people. So clutch control and learning how to stand up when you're scared and sit down when you're not.
Nah, correct. Well, on that, you've built a reputation for reading a motorcycle's behavior before even looking at the rider's behavior. So what bike's movements tell you that the person is not controlling it or controlling it correctly?
All right. So I got to admit this. Okay. I really don't like riders that much, but I love motorcycles. So I'm actually out there to save the motorcycles. And if I watch the bike will tell on the rider every time.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just watching ride across the field, and the bike will be like, damn it, Brett, tell him to friggin' relax because he's holding on too damn tight. So it turns out that the bike will telegraph what's happening before you ever see what the rider's doing.
Oh, yeah.
So I watch the bike first. And when the bike tells me something's going wrong, then I look at the rider to confirm it. And obviously, there's a pattern with this after 30 years of, you know, if this happens, I look for a certain aspect. But as I go up, if a bike looks unstable as it goes through a corner, if it's in a turn, immediately you can look up and you look for tension. You know, okay, what's causing the tension? You know, is there body position wear? And almost tension almost always comes from poor vision. So I see the tension. My eyes go directly to their head. Where are they looking? You know, are they looking in the right spot? Are they looking too far out? Are they looking down? And then I can move down and start looking at shoulders, arms, hands, position. Are they out of balance? What's their speed? Are they going fast? Is that tension and fear coming because it came in too fast? Should they be coming in slower? Is it a slick surface? Did I see them slip just before that caused the tension? So I'm always going through this whole list to try to find the root cause. Yeah. Because if I coach a symptom, we don't solve the problem. So I'm always looking at the bike because the bike's the first thing that tells me what goes wrong.
Oh yeah.
And then it tells me where to look. So that's what I do by that. It's just because I really love motorcycles and I just hate them being abused. So I train so that I can help abused motorcycles get abused less often.
Yeah. So you got to, that's right. The motorcycle is betraying the rider. Absolutely.
Like, Brett, please tell them to stop.
Now, for riders who are transitioning from road to ADV, what's the single most important mindset shift that they need to make to ride safely and confidently out there on the trails?
Number one thing is motorcycles don't want to fall down. Okay. They do everything they can to stay upright, and street riders have a hard time letting go. Let's just say they have control issues. Right? So street riders, when they come out, and I've always said I can make a dirt rider an incredible street rider, but making a street rider an incredible dirt rider is a feat for sure. And what happens is we're not used to the bikes wiggling. So if you think about, like, here's a concept that a lot of riders don't understand, and that's rake and trail and momentum, right? They think you hear this gyroscopic precession. It's the wheel spinning, and that's what makes the bike stable. And it has certain stabilizing characteristics, but it's not actually what rides the bike and keeps it going straight. It's rake and trail, the angle of the forks, and the offset of the steering axis and the axle, right? The pivot of the wheel. And the longer those are, the more stable the bike is in general. And we need momentum behind that. There's mm-hmm. a certain kind of magic number of speed, and it varies. If you say 12 miles, 50 miles, right? Kind of depends on the bike and the situation, but it's somewhere in there. And you start to get an inherent balance. Well, when we are on the road, that front wheel is constantly trying to be knocked over by the back wheel. If you think about it, when you're going down the road, there's one part of the bike that always wants to be in front, and there's one thing that's always in the way. And it's the back wheel that wants to be in front, and the front wheel is always in the way. So as you're driving the back wheel forward, that front wheel is moving left and right constantly as it's being pushed out of center with the back wheel trying to get to the front. Rake and trail is what self-corrects that. So as the wheel starts to tip off one direction, rake and trail bring it back to center, and it just naturally swings through that center the other direction. So you end up with this little wiggle. Well, with high traction and on the street, it happens so quickly, very few of us ever actually feel that happen.
Yeah.
Except sometimes in a corner, when you're leaning over, you'll start to feel the front end a little move and people freak out.
Okay.
It's actually okay. It's not a problem, right? Unless we're holding on too tight, then we die. But as we're off road, it becomes more pronounced, especially in sand. And even street riders have often ridden through gravel or sand, and they feel the front bike, the whole bike starts to wiggle, and they panic and they grab a hold of that bike because they have control issues and they think they're the one keeping that bike upright. And when they lock in on that bar, they keep it from self-correcting. The bike falls down and they blame the bike. Yep. When it wasn't the bike at all, it was them, right? They're the ones wanting to do that. So being able to let that go. And basically the concept, let me simplify for you. It's me teaching riders how to get out of the way.
There you go.
Because they're the problem, right? And I think that's the hardest transition for street riders is to understand that they're the problem, not the solution, and that the bike doesn't want to fall down. And it's the design of that bike. It's the physics behind the riding that keep us upright.
There you go. I say, you know, a funny thing is while I have never ADV ridden, I can tell you that as a mountain biker, when you come to things like sand, soft dirt, gravel, the front wheel wants to stop while the back wheel wants to keep going. So your notion of the front wheel's in the way is 100% true.
yeah, it absolutely is. And people learn, you know, they sometimes slow down when they should speed up, and they just don't understand how those things happen. And certainly if you're a mountain biker, you know, these things make sense when the bike moves around underneath you. And, you know, the difference is, I guess, with a mountain bike and even a dirt bike, a lot of times is that they're light enough that you can kind of muscle it. And even if you're misbehaving, you can get away with it.
Yeah.
when you're riding a 600-pound adventure bike in the sand, you lose.
You're not muscling that.
The fight's lost. So it becomes, and I think this is why I absolutely love adventure riding so much, and so much more than I think any other aspect of riding. And like I said, I've done road racing and everything else, and I love so much of this, and I love traveling and road riding. I love road riding, but adventure riding is because it's such a strategic game.
Yeah,
you have to be able to think your way through it. You can't muscle through. And as I get older, that's the thing I have left, right? I mean, I don't have the same physical abilities I had. I don't have the same fear threshold that I have because I don't bounce anymore. I just sort of crack.
Flop.
And you just sort of land with a thud instead of a bounce, and you don't jump back up anymore, you know? And so I think adventure riding allows me to ride at a lower speed and to ride in an environment where it's still very challenging because it engages my mind, it engages my skills. But when I have a mishap, you know, a lot of times I'm running at a much slower speed. You have tip overs. You're not crashing.
Yeah.
And tip overs are okay. That's not a problem. You know, we pick it up and we go. But when you crash, bad things happen.
Yeah.
And the older we get, the more often it's bad.
Yeah. Now, with ADV riding, as far as it goes for training or even just in general, I know that, again, going back to mountain biking, there's a thing called body English. Does that apply with ADV riding as well?
Well, define what you mean by body English. Give me an example.
That is, you're navigating through a tight space, for example, and you're going to use your body to offset or counterweight the bike so you can do what you need to do. And it's those little movements that you make that keep you where the bike likes to be, which is upright. So yes. Does the same thing apply with ADV?
100%, but it's even more critical.
Uh-huh.
And again, if you think about it, it's a mass equation.
Yeah.
So if you've got this bike that's underneath you that weighs, you know, 50 pounds or 20 pounds or whatever your bike is, you know, depending if it's electric or not or whatever.
Death to electric.
You know, and you're riding on top of it. And let's just say I'm 195 pounds, right? And I know a lot of guys, we're going to be spanning on both sides of this number. I have a significant weight advantage over that bicycle.
No, yeah.
And so if I move, it's going to move and it's going to make a difference. When I'm riding 600 pounds and I'm 200 pound rider, 195, I'm a third of the weight, which means that I have to be more precise, more accurate, and more exaggerated to get the effects that are necessary. So you, again, goes back to, you need to understand what those are and how to get there and how to move. And again, I work with an older audience. So my average riders are 45 to 65, and I span outside of that up into the 70s. And I've had a rider over 80, you know, come out with me. Oh, and I get guys down into their, you know, I've had one teenager and, you know, sometimes in their 20s, but it's pretty solid. You know, that 45 to 65 is a pretty good solid bell curve there. You know, that's not your prime physical age. So again, limitations, weight, you know, life, careers, families, all these things take a toll. And so again, we have to be wiser about how we understand this so that we can make this happen. And what makes my job fun is working around all these limitations.
Yeah.
Working around the fact that, you know, somebody comes out and they're on a bike with a 34-inch seat height and they're 5'6". I think that's awesome. I think it's great, you know, because now I have to go, well, let's learn the techniques, get around that.
Yeah.
Or you know, you come out with a guy who's, you know, he rolls into class and he's 280 pounds. And you're like, this is a big boy. And he goes, yeah, I lost 150 pounds.
True story. Wow.
True story. Right.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what. And, you know, there's a lot, you know, the body doesn't just recover from that sort of a lifestyle. But the fact that they're out there trying to do things and they are so incredibly thankful that they're not being judged and they're allowed to do this. And I'm like, of course you're allowed to do this.
Yeah.
But I get to work around those limitations. I get to work around those challenges and help them achieve that. And that makes it so much fun because every rider to me has a unique story. And, you know, I just have to figure out how the physics don't change, but the way we get them to work does.
Ah,
and
there
that's a hoot. It's a fun.
All right. Awesome. All right. So you did an article for Cruiser Magazine. It's Special Forces and the Meaning of Ass. So in the article, you talk about Special Forces concept of embracing the suck. Now, how does that mindset translate to becoming a better ADV rider?
All right. First of all, we have to understand why it's called ASS. So I have a little bit of a humor on my side. I created a course out on a, and this was based off of this program, and it was called Smart ASS. And it was actually scan, mark, adjust, react, react and throttle. And then ASS was just advanced street skills. So,
advanced street skills. Okay.
And you know how much I had to work at it to get that acronym to work. Cause I was like, what words can we use? Cause damn it, I'm going to make this happen. So, so that's where that came from. And I did the program. So the program I did for the special forces was not, I did some downrange combat stuff with them and things, but the main program I did with them was actually street riding. Now, this was them riding on their own personal bikes. These were usually experienced, they were all experienced riders. Many of them are instructors. And my goal was to change the culture in their riding with the special forces groups. And so we had to go in and really training was the venue or the way that I helped achieve that, right? Because if I could convince them they could ride better, then I had their attention. What I really had to do is change their mindset, how they looked at things, how they made choices. And you don't do that by making rules. And now that this program is dead and I don't have to do it anymore, I can tell you that there were a lot of rules and laws broken along the way because I can't go, hey, we're going to follow all the laws and rules and we're going to ride at this pace and we're going to have this stagger formation and this is how we're going to do the training, because as soon as nobody's watching, they're going to ride the way they ride.
Yeah.
And then I've never had a chance to do that. So I just went, we're not your mothers. We're not here to babysit you. And we're not here to report on you. And we would just go ride. And they would ride at the pace they did, do the same stupid things they do. And our goal was to give them education, experience, and skill sets that allowed them to make choices to change the way they rode, to make them safer riders. I didn't say legal riders, safe riders, so that they would make better choices. And that's the direction we went with that. So the advanced street skills were all about that. The embrace the suck is a term that comes from the Army guys. And that's just when things really, really suck. You got to go with it, which, for the adventure riding, you always hear me say attitude matters. And I would say, smile while you ride, attitude matters. And guys go, oh, yeah, I always smile when I ride because I'm having a great time. I'm like, no, you're missing the point. It's like me being out the other day with a brand new motorcycle that didn't belong to me and me punching a hole in the engine case. That's not the time to throw a fit. That's when you're like, okay, well, here I am. How do we make the best out of this? How do we get out of this situation, get home? What do I learn from it? And that's the attitude that matters. And the embrace the suck is that same concept of just, look, if you have a bad attitude, if you're just thinking about how awful things are, well, you're not going to improve. And that's never going to help a situation. So, just calm down, embrace the suck, or in my case, attitude matters. Keep a positive outlook and just, remember you paid a lot of money to be doing what you're doing. You put a lot of effort into going to where you go. So when shit goes wrong, embrace it. Yep. You chose this, right? Yeah. You chose this.
Well, you see, you describe in the article how discomfort and adversity reveal a rider's habits. Okay, now what's an example of stress habit that you see often that you have to try to break a rider of?
So in that situation, a lot of those guys, it's an environment. Now, most people would think these guys they should have been the ideal rider. If you think about it, they're all military aged. These aren't new guys. These are special forces. So they're not coming in as 18 or 20 year olds. These guys are all senior NCOs and above. They're locked in. They're the smartest guys in the Army. And these guys are sharp. I mean, they really are. Their support guys are good. The team guys are amazing. I mean, they are brilliant guys. They are very average riders, and it turns out that, for them, we had to show them what they didn't know to get them to want to know more. And one of the ways I did this is we had a knowledge exam we would give them on the way in and the way out. Now, realize this program developed, from day one all the way through. We were changing it sometimes weekly. We would just keep evolving it, same way I do the adventure program. And we had the freedom to do that because our results were amazing, right? The Army, they never questioned us. We had no bad reviews the whole time. And they basically just said, don't ask them questions. Just go do your training. We don't want to know what you're doing because it works. And if we ask questions, we might not be able to let you do it. And so I guess having these riders take these tests thinking they know what they do, and even though we told them, you're not supposed to know this. This is, we're going to give you the same test at the end of the week. You don't have to know any of this. We just want to know where you're starting. And asking them questions like, if you have a modern sport bike on clean, dry pavement, what is the full potential of the front brake in that braking environment in a maximum braking situation? And they look down the list and like, well, 70, 30, 80, 20, 90, 10, whatever it is. And they'll pop in 70, 30 because that's what they were taught in their MSF class. Mm-hmm. Well, every single one of them has seen a sport bike do a stoppie. How much braking is that back wheel doing if it's up in the air? Like, well, nothing, right? Well, duh. Well, why aren't you guys thinking, right? Because they weren't taught to think anymore. And these guys are the best in the Army. If anybody can think in the Army, it's these guys. And so when we went through and we were asking all these different questions, like, you know, what's the threshold of traction? 10% slip, 5% slip, 15%, 0% slip, negative 10%. And then while we threw, and when they go, well, we mean it's 10% slip. If the tire is slipping, how's that maximum traction? We had to go through shear factors and talking about all these advantages, but it brought to their attention that they didn't know shit.
Wow.
And that was huge.
That's quite revealing.
And we went out road with them, did the same thing. And we weren't trying to embarrass them riding, but when they saw that they're riding, they were the best in their group, but that just meant their group sucked. They all of a sudden, these guys aren't used to not being the best. And they anteed up. As soon as they realized that they weren't the top of their game, they were 100% in. Like, okay, come on, teach me what I got to know.
Wow.
And so that's where that humility, that adversity, that stress, you know, really gave us an advantage. And you know, you can't reach everybody, but you certainly, you know, do your best.
Yeah. Now, in the article, you got into hardship and its meaning and purpose. Now, how can riders use that idea to stay focused and safe when they're on the trail, when fear starts to creep in?
So I think what you're alluding to here is, you know, when we look at military, and this is true for law enforcement and fire, and I'm former fire in another lifetime, you know, when I was young, we train through fear, right? So they train to run into situations that the rest of us instinctively run away from, mm-hmm. right? If you hear gunfire, we usually don't run to it, right? That's a bad thing, you know? Usually. If a building's on fire, most of us go, this is bad, we should leave. Right. And we do, and that's a good thing. But yet firefighters are running into that building.
Right.
And so what they learn is that training, the only way that training can be effective is if it's a reactive thing, right? If it's just what you do without any thought. And so they learn how to push through these terrifying environments. And most of these guys that I worked with, these are combat veterans. These are not just, you know, weekend guys. These guys have actually been in combat and they've been in those situations, and you still have to do what you have to do. There is no option to opt out.
Right.
I've got a great story about, I don't know if you guys are into philosophy, but I'd love to share you a philosophy
story. Go ahead.
Story if
you're... Fire away.
Okay. So so you might know, and those of you listening right now, of the great philosopher, Homer. Everybody knows
Homer.
The philosopher?
Yes.
Right? The great American philosopher, Homer Simpson. Okay.
Oh, go, so please go on. I would love to hear this.
I've told this story many, many times. So here's a story about philosophy story from the great American philosopher Homer Simpson. So Homer Simpson has three children, and you know, specifically has two older ones. One's good, one's bad. Right. So we have Bart, he's the bad one. We have Lisa, she's always the good one. In this particular story, Lisa is at school and she's just really upset with what the school's doing. It's not meeting her agendas. You know, we know she's, you know, kind of this liberal minded kid, and so she's really upset. So she's acting out and she's just causing all kinds of trouble at school. And Bart's watching this. He's like, hot damn, you know, this time it's not me. So finally word gets back to Homer and he's standing there, and Bart's standing in the corner watching, just giggling, because you know it's Lisa's time. She's gonna get busted, and Lisa's there. And Bart looks at Lisa, or Homer. Homer looks at Lisa, and he looks at Bart, and he looks at Lisa, he looks at Bart, and he goes, Bart, come to your room. And Bart's like, what are you talking about? I didn't do it. Lisa, and he goes, boy, in times of trouble, you go with what you know. And that's exactly what we do as riders. You know, if we never practice, riding under stress, if we never practice riding at certain lean angles, at certain speeds, if we never practice braking at certain, trying to brake to a 1G threshold, which is what most bikes are capable of, is near 1G, plus or minus 0.1. Then when it happens, it's not magically going to happen. You know, you took an MSF class, you got an A score. That's a 0.63 braking. You know, the average rider out there, ABS or not, is around 0.7. You know, your minivan stopping at 0.96. You know, you suck, right? Whether you have ABS or not, you're underbraking these bikes. And if you think that suddenly you're going to have that ability to stop behind a car because, you know, it's an emergency, you're wrong, right? We are reactive. And that goes back to this adversity thing, this ability to train through their fear.
Right.
So that their habits become the first reaction, not the fear. And they use that to their advantage so that we can advance our skills as riders. And we often would take their real life experiences and tie them into the training, even so much as the way they shoot and the way they use their vision, you know, the way they open up their vision so they can track more area rather than pinpoint. And as riders, we focus, but we shouldn't be. We should be opening our vision so we're picking up on both sides and all the area for movement. And then when we get movement that's threat, then we change our vision. And we are able to take these skill sets they have and hone them and use them effectively.
Wow, great. That's some good stuff, man. Wow. All right, I have for you right now is 10 rapid-fire questions. Are you ready?
Shit.
You're ready.
All right, here goes.
Brace yourself. Okay, here we go. Number one.
Yes, no, green, blue. yes, eggs, and shoot, that last one got me.
All right, well, okay. There we go. Ready? Number one, hard panniers or soft luggage?
Oh, my gosh. These are supposed to be fast?
Well,
you got to give me context. Where am I going?
No, it doesn't matter.
Okay. If I'm going to Argentina, then I'm taking hard panniers. If I'm going to South Africa from Spain, I'm taking soft panniers.
All right. I didn't think it was going to be that difficult. Favorite terrain, sand, mud, rock, or forest two-track?
I get a hoot out of mud. It kicks my ass.
Really?
And I like things that are challenging.
Wow, how about that? Most underrated ADV skill.
Most underrated ADV skill. A rolling mount and a rolling dismount.
Ooh, that's interesting. Wow, okay. Mm-hmm. Bike you would take around the world tomorrow.
Around the world. If I did that today, holy shit, around the world. Like, okay, are we going top to bottom or are we going around the equator? That makes
sense. Yeah, we're going around the equator.
Around the equator. If I did it tomorrow, gosh, I would say I'm going to have to take, I was going to say BMW because I had the same bikes in every country. You can always get parts for it. The Himalayan is quite the beast. I'm going to have to take a BMW. I don't want that 1300 because that damn thing keeps breaking. I think I'm going to take an older 1200 BMW.
There you go. Okay, cool.
It is not the best bike, but it sure would be a hell of a lot of fun.
Coffee before or after the ride?
Oh, never before.
Never before?
Never before, because then you get about halfway through and then you're looking for a bathroom because everything just broke loose. I can't do that.
Most common bad habit riders don't know they have.
Morning wood riding posture.
Yeah.
Yeah. They stand up. They look, I came up with that term recently. It's the only way to describe it. They look like morning wood as they're riding their adventure bike. They're just locked out straight up. They don't move. The bike leans. They're still with it. They're not leaning forward or back. They're just stuck straight up in the air. And I'm like, guys, that's a terrible way to ride.
Relax. Yeah. GPS or paper maps?
We're in a modern age. I'll take GPS.
All right. Best training drill for 5 spare minutes.
Best train, dead. So I would say a full lock, you know, U-turn.
Really?
Full lock U-turns at the lowest speed you can go.
Holy
if you
crap.
Can stop in the middle of the U-turn and keep going, then that allows balance. You're off center. It's a clutch and clutch balance and brake drill. It mixes everything.
Really? Wow. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Dream riding destination you haven't hit yet.
Haven't hit yet. Dream. God, I love being warm. So let's see. I've been all through there. You know what? I have not been to Kenya yet. Well, I think I want to go to Kenya.
There you go. There's a new location for your school.
Yeah, right. I have trained in South Africa and I've done tours down in Botswana, but Kenya, I don't think I quite have the market for that one.
What about Namibia?
I've been through Namibia. There's not many people, but it's super cool. I've got pictures of me up at the border of Angola, and that's where the tribes are, where they cover themselves in mud.
Oh, geez.
And so you go out and the women, it looks like National Geographic, all the things you saw in Angola. You've got boobs flapping around and mud caked in hair and kids with stuff, you know. But yeah, that was a really cool, really cool coming out of Angola. And that's at the top of Namibia. And then as you come down, it just turns into pure sand and no people. It's quite the experience.
Wow. All right. Number 10, last one. One piece of gear you'd never leave behind.
My credit card.
Seriously? Of all the things, your credit card.
Well, and I tell you, this is why people overpack constantly, especially when they're new.
Yeah.
And I can always buy it. You know, if I'm short on something, if I'm cold, if I'm hot, if I'm whatever, I can always end up purchasing whatever that gear is. And I've changed different boots and helmets. And obviously, I'm going to find a helmet anywhere. There's always gear you're going to have. But yeah, if you got a credit card, you can solve pretty much anything.
You know, it's funny because
I'm going to call that important.
When you talk about packing too much or whatever, I've always went on the notion that if you don't have it, you can't put it on. That kind of a thing. So you bring it. But then it's a question, do I need it? Am I going to need it? Maybe. Well, I don't know. Maybe. So you just bring it anyway. I mean, conundrum.
It's absolutely 100%. And, the interesting thing is after all my travels, and like I said, I've ridden from all of North Central South America all the way down to Argentina. I've done Europe down to South Africa doing the West Coast. So, the Congo and Nigeria, and I've ridden in all those countries. I take tours over to China and Nepal. My packing list that I have, whether I go on a 4-month trip, whether I'm doing a weekend over in Iceland, or whether I'm here in the States doing a weekend, is almost identical.
Really?
It changes almost not at all. Now, I might change the type of riding gear I'm bringing, like a different jacket if it's a four season versus, if I'm going for a short week and I know what kind of temperature it is, I might choose something different than if I'm going through all four seasons. Like a lot of these world trips, you're going everything from freezing to, 100 plus degrees. So, that's a different pick.
Yeah.
But the same number of underwear, pants, T-shirts, there's always a button-up shirt so I can clean up, when I'm out traveling. Mm-hmm. That stuff stays the same. The tools. It doesn't matter whether I'm stuck in the Owyhees, south of my house here in Idaho, or whether I'm in Namibia. Shit's broke. Right? And I'm on my own, right? Yeah. So if I can't fix it, we got a problem, And
credit card.
Exactly. Well, sometimes if you're in the middle of nowhere, that's a problem too. So maybe I should have said cash. If we're talking world travel, maybe cash is a better call. But yeah, it's... anyways, that's kind of where I was
going. Right. Well, Brett,
I can just keep rattling on.
No, I get it, dude.
Like, hold it. Stop. We've got a time limit here at some point.
Yeah. Well, hey, listen, I want to thank you very much for being on the podcast. You've been an absolute joy to have on, very informative, very, learning. I learned stuff. So. But thank you very much for being on the show. Hey, listen, don't go anywhere. I want to talk to you when we're done. All right?
All right.
Thank you, Brett. Take care. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on board. And it's been a pleasure. Great questions. You had me thinking on a few of those.
Good.
I really appreciate that.
You're welcome, man. Thanks a lot for being on the show. All right. That wraps up our conversation with Brett Tax, a rider, instructor, and thinker who continues to push the ADV community toward smarter, safer, and more intentional riding. Whether you're new to the dirt or decades deep in the sport, there's always another layer to learn. And Brett has a way of making those lessons stick. So thanks for joining me and Brett here in the V-Twin Cafe, where he told us all about his training courses. Now you can learn more about Brett by getting on over to bretttax.com. That's BRETTKACS.com. Links will be in the show notes and, of course, on the Motorcycle Men website at motomenpc.com. Hey, don't forget to get over to the Ride with Ted YouTube channel and watch some of the many videos I have there. And if you'd please, also like and subscribe. That would be a tremendous help to the channel and, of course, to the podcast. Don't forget, you can get my book, The Road Most Traveled, right now on the Motorcycle Men website.
course, it's still available on Amazon, and the audiobook is still available on Audible. Hey, for the rest of the Motorcycle Men team, thanks for tuning in, thanks for supporting the show, and as always, keep the rubber side down, the shiny side up, and thanks for listening. And remember, we say stupid crap so you don't have to. Ride safely, kids, and we'll catch you on the next episode.